inexplicable, no warning, nothing said, just hate and violence. That's all it was. Wish I could say that this was an isolated situation. Unfortunately, it's not. We've had 13 acts of anti-Semitism since December 8th in New York State. I'd like to say it's only those 13, but the truth is we've had incidents of hate all across the state.
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo after Saturday's horrific machete attack at a synagogue in Rockland County, New York. Hello, everyone. Matt Welch here, and welcome to what will mostly be a special year-end, decade-end, lives-end edition of the Reason Roundtable. But we shall also discuss at the top here some issues in the news with our crack roundtable-listas, Peter Suderman, Catherine Mankiw Ward, and very special guest star, Rabe Suave Rabe.
Wow, strong start.
Rabe, that's it. You're never getting a last name from me again.
Sounds like some sort of Italian ice cream.
Eve.
Yeah. Rabe.
That was... Say hello, everyone.
Hi.
Howdy.
Happy New Year.
Wow. Enthusiasm again. It's infectious. We'll be getting into the good stuff of how we all got everything wrong a bit later. I mean, mostly Peter. But first, since we've got young Rabe around the table, you wrote a piece just this morning cautioning not to jump to conclusions about an increase in anti-Semitic attacks. As someone who lives in New York City, got to say, it feels like there's a lot more now. Feels like I'm on team Cuomo here, which is not a comfortable place to be. Walk us through the math here a bit, Rabe, of why we should be cautious in leaping to conclusions.
Right. Facts don't care about your feelings, Matt. So, you know, keep
Thank
that in
you,
mind.
Rabe.
The data is, you can parse it a lot of ways. It does look like there has been an increase in anti-Semitic incidents from last year to this year in New York City, about a 50% increase, you know, like 112 to 180, something like that. Not all of these violent incidents, in fact, the vast majority are classified by the police as nonviolent, as vandalism, graffiti, that kind of thing. And that's always the caution you have to apply, because a lot of the agencies or activist groups that count or tally anti-Semitism, like the Anti-Defamation League, you know, they're looking at things. Their tally will include things like schoolyard bullying, taunts, written verbal messages that are anti-Semitic. Again, all of this is very bad, but we want to be careful. You know, not all of this even criminal if you're looking at what the ADL is counting. So I always want to be careful about like scaring people into thinking there's this new wave of anti-Semitism and violence and it's the worst it's ever been, when it doesn't quite look like that if you're absorbing all the data. And of course, it also doesn't really fit the profile that I think many in the media are most concerned about. Like when I testified on the rising white supremacy and hate crimes a few months ago before Congress, you know, it was all about how we've not been concerned enough about the alt-right and white supremacist violence. But of course, you know, the kinds of things we're seeing in New York are not perpetrated by people who fit that profile whatsoever in the vast majority of cases. So it's kind of I think there's a lot of ways this has been talked about not totally correctly.
We'll hold on to that notion for a little bit later, but I wanted to follow up with you, Rabe, about your experience in doing research and interviews for your great book, Panic Attack. So you spent a lot of time, or some time, with alt-right, but also with campus kind of left-wing agitators and things like that. What was your perception of the role either of anti-Semitism or one might posit it as like sort of an Israel or Jewish obsessed adjacency to anti-Semitism that you saw just in your experience of going around and interviewing people and also hearing what other people said about the same question?
Yeah, there's no question I saw it. I have a chapter on the alt-right specifically in my book, and it's totally kooky, fringe, crazy, overt anti-Semitism is totally normal to the alt-right. And also there's I would say a little bit of it, or it's more kind of more beneath the surface, but still definitely prevalent. among the not quite all the way alt-right or people who have disassociated themselves from the alt-right. The kind of groiper people is actually what we're supposed to be calling them now.
I'm sorry, they're what?
They're called the groipers.
Good God.
Can you spell that?
G-R-O-Y-P-E-R.
What does that mean?
Are we having
is
a genuine word?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's, so that this is...
Not all of us have Reddit accounts.
it's based on
most of us do.
It comes from a meme. I think it's another even a frog meme of some kind, and I won't get into its origin story even any more than that. But these are one of the leaders of this group is Nick Fuentes, who's a young campus activist. These people are actually picking lots of fights with Turning Point USA right now because they're saying Turning Point is not pro-nationalist, like all the way ethno-state nearly enough, and they're a bunch of cucks, guys, so we gotta really hold them accountable. They harassed Ben Shapiro on the street the other day, you know,
right?
One of the criticisms being that Ben Shapiro is too Jewish and too pro-Israel, so a lot of that stuff going on, not even on the far alt-right.
They're the toads to Pepe's frog.
Toad and frog. This is a toad and frog kind of thing.
Well, I didn't mean in a toad and frog way. I guess I just meant in a...
Let's ruin all childhood memories
toad,
here.
Like, toads are just grosser frogs.
We'll get to Star Wars a little later.
That's true. And then just to close the thought, on the left, a certain strain of deeply progressive campus activism. You know, some of it is just criticism of Israel, and I don't think all criticism of Israel should be considered, you know, necessarily anti-Semitic, but certainly it crosses the line sometimes, or they're using kind of calling card words, dog whistles of more anti-Semitic belief in, you know, we saw that in the Women's March, the inability to separate from deeply anti-Semitic figures like the Nation of Islam people.
Peter, let's pick up on one of the threads from earlier, and also in the spirit of, as you put it on the Slack channel, I'm going to throw you some rando stuff that you're not prepared for.
Private Slack channel.
Is it? Is anything
2010s heralded the end of privacy, and I think we're seeing that play out on this podcast
right now.
So one of the critiques that you see a lot of right now is that the media, which let's posit leans left of center, does not cover left bent or even WTF bent anti-Semitism with nearly the same gusto and verve as it does if acts of or perceived acts of anti-Semitism are seen as coming from the alt-right or some kind of Trump overlap crew. Do you think that's a fair complaint?
It's possible it's fair in some circumstances. At the same time, right of center anti-Semitism in my impression of it, I guess I haven't done like a thorough Robbie Suave level, you know, Excel spreadsheet study of incidents. But my impression is that when we have seen anti-Semitic acts of violence from the right, they have tended to be much more clear in their kind of political, in the ideology that they're espousing while they carry out this violence. And if you sort of compare the shootings in Texas and then in Ohio that happened earlier this year on the same weekend, you had some lefty-ish connections for the Ohio shooter, but it was also just much less clear what he was doing. It wasn't obvious certainly immediately that he was killing people for lefty political reasons. And so in some ways, the kind of the tendency towards manifestoism on the right with the New Zealand shooter, with the El Paso shooter, has drawn coverage towards making some of those connections a little bit more explicit. At the same time, in some ways, I want to reject the premise of this question just a little bit, which is to say that there's just a tendency on both sides right now that when acts of violence, of horrific violence happen, to try and say, well, it's the other side's fault somehow or another, or, you know, or at the very least, it's not our political side's fault, but to try and find some way to say that, well, look, let's blame this on our political enemies. And no one is helped by, say, arguing to Jews, you know, look, like an argument that is basically Democrats are going to be worse for you, or Republicans are going to be worse for you. Like, if that's the political argument we're having, that's a sad and bad argument to be having about anti-Semitic violence. And I just think it's sort of a endemic of a very bad tendency in cultural and political discourse right now to turn absolutely everything into a very simple partisan slugfest. And it's not helpful.
Catherine, building on that, as someone who is married both to the distinction between correlation and causation, and also married to the tribe, for crying out loud, looking at this and the discussion thereof, isn't the better play not to go all micro, as Peter rightly points out, that people tend to do immediately in these situations, and you know, regenerating the awfulness of discourse, but making the broader, less directly tied, you know, historical insight that, hey, look, populism of both left and right has not necessarily been congenial to transnational groups of perceived size and influence, which is something to keep in mind as we are also looking at the very micro level of what kind of terrible, creepy people are running around synagogues with machetes.
Yeah, I mean, I think the word populism is the right one to kind of look at here rather than it was the right wingers that made me do it. It was the left wingers that made me do it. Like, that only gets you so far. Whereas I think you're quite right to note that populist movements have historically not been kind to Jews in particular. There's a tendency to scapegoat certain populations when things go badly in a populist or nationalist kind of context. And it has too often been Jews. I was actually really struck by, I was looking at a write-up of what happened this weekend, and the New York Times article, I think, just in passing said, you know, experts say anti-Semitic violence has been on the rise. Might have been in the Post, actually. In 2018, a gunman stormed into Pittsburgh's Tree of Life synagogue, killing 11 congregants and wounding 6 others. It was the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in the history of the United States, which is actually a very striking sentence. Like, is 11 deaths really the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in the history of the United States? And if so, good work, United States, I guess, because that number's a lot bigger.
Kind of a grisly sliding scale,
yeah,
there.
But it's, you know, again, like all of the, you know, obvious caveats here of like zero deaths and zero woundings and zero graffiti incidents is what we're going for here. But, you know, there are some famous, much larger numbers in other nations and
in
all the other nations, in fact,
pretty much.
And, you know, it doesn't actually, like, in the same way that it is not helpful in the discourse to be like, oh, Donald Trump made them do it, or, oh, like, you know, Ilhan Omar made them do it. It is also weirdly unhelpful to say, actually, no one's dying. But as we've talked about on this podcast before, statistically speaking, no one's dying. And that's good. Not no one,
but very few people for reasons of obvious
people even and makes people even on this very podcast uncomfortable to say.
Very few people dying for reasons of obvious ideological extremism. I mean, that we're trying to find motivations always in these crimes. I think that's a very human impulse to understand exactly why, exactly what this person was thinking and how they formed their views and how they took very clear logical steps that are consistent and make sense to us.
And yet,
to carry
we
this
also
out.
Always say it was an inexplicable act of violence, right? Like, that clip at the top of the show started with the word inexplicable. Right. And then we're like, it's inexplicable. Here's the explanation. Anti-Semitism.
Right. But often it just is inexplicable. Like, these don't fit as clearly. I mean, think of the Vegas shooters, the most, you know, inexplicable, right? That killed so many people. We'll never understand it better than we do. Does it really matter? Part of me says, does it matter? I mean, like, death is death and violence is violence and it's bad, sort of regardless of whether we can exactly figure out or calibrate the why of the...
So I think there is an understandable reason why people want to figure out the motivations here, which is that people want to know what is causing this. And to some degree, you know, you can say that there is just a practical reason, which is that if you understand why people are committing acts of horrific violence, then that is... at least theoretically, a step towards stopping it. I think it's also just that when you have events like this, the idea that they're completely inexplicable is one that's very hard for people to accept, because it means that you have no control. It means that you have that it's not this something that you can fit into any kind of narrative. And events that don't fit into a clear story
are especially troubling to narrative oriented people, like, for instance, journalists.
Yeah, right. It is a reminder that the world is chaotic and violent and unpleasant,
but less so than it used to be.
That's true, but in a way that really disturbs people. And I think it's even, you know, we have to accept that there's some amount of chaos and some amount of the world that is inexplicable. At the same time, it's understandable that people would want to have clear stories about how the world works and why it works the way it does.
I think that you people and I people tend to get our nose stuck in the slide rules a little bit and insist on evidence, which is the right play in all cases. But that might lead us to be slower on recognizing a trend. Previewing the ritual self-criticism here and even going in a direction I didn't want to. But if I think about my tenure as editor, I think we recognized the 2008 financial crisis late, and we recognized the recovery from it also late, because we were, where is it?
That's how you're supposed to do it. That's the right way to recognize trends, is to wait until the trend is firmly established before declaring it a trend rather than a blip.
Wait,
how we do the trends. Trends
are. Have you met journalists?
I have, hate them.
The whole point of the punditry industry is to say that things are happening because you feel like they might be happening.
And because
or
one
might
person
happen.
Tweeted yeah. something to that
one,
effect.
One person tweets something. That's the new rule of three. Like, that's now, a trend that you can, that, like, it's definitively happening. This person has over 100 followers, 112 followers, and they tweeted something. That means
it's
real
always 112 followers. That's the exact right
I would
of
like to see. I would like
trend.
To see Rob Bay's spreadsheet looked at, and this is going to sound weird and crass, but walk with me through it, that shows the number of attacks on Orthodox Jews, by which I mean people you can see down the street and say, "Whoo, humdinger, look at that hat. Look at those little curls coming down." Like, I can visualize this.
Is this conversation going to end
Jewish.
Up on the list?
Yeah.
Yes,
are we?
It is already. No, because the experience of people in Williamsburg right now is there's a sense of living in terror. And I think a number of the attacks have come in those communities, as opposed to the Upper East Side or someplace where you're not going to see large Orthodox, but you're seeing visual Jew. Look, visual Jew over there. Let's get him. I think that is on the increase, is my hunch. And Catherine, call me non-data oriented, but this is my strong hunch.
May very well be correct, but it could also be the case that these things have always been happening to this community specifically, perpetrated by the same people, and we were not paying as much attention to it as we are right now. There was no national, because there was no idea that there was a trend, there was not national coverage paying attention to this. Police were not classifying these things that way. This data was not being collected along those lines. So it could, because we are certainly more attuned to the issue of hate crimes now in Trump's America for various reasons than we were at any time previously in the last 20 years, probably. So again, it could be that these things are getting worse in some specific context. I think that's could be true and is supported by some data, but that data could also be there because these things are being counted by people who are much more aware of the problem.
And in fact, this has been a legitimate complaint from Jewish communities in the United States for a long time, is that when, you know, a shop is broken into or a house is vandalized or somebody gets beat up on the street, that law enforcement doesn't take notice of the motivations. Again, getting back to the fact that we have this belief that by knowing motivations, we can forestall future incidents. And so it's frustrating to people who perceive that they have been victimized because of something about their identity to have it just show up on the police ledger as like a literal broken window.
All right, Catherine, before we get into the meat of the rest of the program, I'm going to give you editrix prerogative here and let you stand even more over Mayor Pete. Why, if you voted, would he have come slightly closer to earning your vote in a Democratic primary?
Mayor Pete did a good this week. He so he actually has done this good thing before, and people didn't notice it much. So we're just gonna.
Did you just like pat him on the head?
I did.
Like that was like an air, like a metaphor. Like
you
want to
pat him on the head when you see him. He's like head. He's working so hard. He's followed all the rules. Don't you want to pat him on the head? I do. He said this before. Actually, this is a platform that he has. A plank that he has put in his platform already, but he got some attention this weekend for saying that he does not think that incarceration is the correct response to possession of any drugs. And it was, you know, I think it's been quite interesting to see both. I think this happened in a, I want to say it was a Des Moines Register, you know, editorial board meeting, but the reaction in real time was one of a certain amount of surprise, as if, you know, people couldn't quite believe what they were hearing. There is actually a very standard reaction to this claim made in almost any sort of mainstream context, which is people start listing drugs. Like maybe you don't know about all the drugs. And if they say the really bad one, you'll be like, oh no, wait, I'm sorry. I take it all back. Like I forgot about heroin. Like that's like so common. It's like, I would decriminalize all drugs. And people are like, but cocaine and heroin? And meth. Like if they say the right drug, you'll be like, never mind. Actually, let's keep going with the drug war. It's going great. But yeah, Mayor Pete out there saying the thing that more politicians should say and saying it with some due deliberation behind it, unlike many of our other presidential candidates and indeed presidents who sometimes just say stuff without apparently having thought about it a lot. You know, this is something that I hope and expect to see more of. It's correct. It's a correct answer to say finding someone in possession of meth, like sending them to jail, doesn't really solve all of the problems that we are attempting to address here.
Possibly it creates a few.
And again, I am 100% sure that as president, Pete Buttigieg would do the wrong thing. Just want to be clear. He would not do this right. He would do it wrong in some important way. But it was nice to hear him say.
Yeah, and especially given that the way that people tend to work through their own applied anti-prohibitionism is usually to say, yeah, you know, it's terrible. You shouldn't put any pot smokers in jail anymore. And that's why we need to crack down on the opioid crisis once and for all, fill in the blank, or, you know, vaping or things like that. So it's nice to get them all in a single paragraph. There, Mayor Pete. I should also testify here and spread throughout the land a completely unfounded. this is worse than many manifestos that I got from the farmers market mushroom salesman. This is about evolution. You ready for it?
This is journalism, Matt. This is how it works.
Yeah. Did you ask your cab driver what he thought about this afterwards?
Did he tweet this from his account with 112 followers?
Go ahead. Tell us.
This guy with like wild, like red beard and just hair coming everywhere. My 11-year-old asked like a good question, which is how did people first learn to eat mushrooms? And this led to discussions about trial and error and psilocybin. And the guy's like, well, actually, there's a theory going around that psilocybin mushrooms are what separated us from the monkeys.
What?
So I'm just spreading
like,
that out there.
How?
I want somebody
what?
To do some research.
I thought you were going to go Jonathan Swift here, which I guess you sort of did with the like brave is the man who first ate an oyster kind of vibe. Like,
is that some Bill Crystal poetry there?
It's
brave is the man.
It's a good insight, right? Like, do you look at an oyster and be like, that's a source of nutrition? No, it looks like somebody hawked up a loogie inside a rock. But you know what? The people who figured that out lived.
Yeah, but that's also why I never eat oysters, because come on, that's gross. Okay.
I mean, if you've seen the early 1980s movie Altered States, you know that experiments with like mind altering drugs and those sensory deprivation chambers are what take us to the next stage of evolution. And I think it's pretty obvious that the monkeys figure that out, and that's how we're here.
Isn't that also a theory of like the geometric patterns in cave paintings and stuff? Is that people basically, in an attempt to like simulate, you know, spiritual states or something, like had some mushrooms and then went in a really dark place and with some finger paint.
I'm pretty sure this is the plot of that really bad Alien prequel that Ridley Scott made, a couple of Prometheus.
It's definitely like, I think either that's,
okay. I think it wasn't really
exactly
bad.
Or it's
the
possibly
plot of
in like Clan of the Cave Bear, if I'm being quite honest here. So,
oh,
yeah,
dear
sorry,
God.
Everyone.
Monkeys, cavemen, by the way, hyper-violent. So much violence. We are doing so much better. Their database of violent incidents would be insane. They're just ritualistic.
I'm sorry, are you right now staking out the monkeys are anti-Semitic take here? Is that,
lots
is
of
that
hate crimes
happened?
Before we evolved.
It's true.
More than that, I think you are drawing a direct connection between the use of like psilocybin and hallucinogenic mushrooms and the decline in hate crimes. Is that what you're saying? Like,
get those charts. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Correlation, folks.
Speaking of things,
we're doing a lot of great journalism here.
We got wrong.
Basically, everything in this podcast will just be what we
so
use
far.
For our 2020, what we got wrong.
Who knew that the anchor to rationality here was Nick Gillespie? But apparently, that's the case. Okay.
I refuse to accept that.
We'd still be talking about altered states if Nick was on this podcast.
That's true. Ayahuasca, FTW. All right, Peter, you're going to go first. What were you wrong about in 2019?
I mean, probably a few things. I think, let's see, I was wrong about how bad the new Star Wars would be. I thought that it would be semi-competent and sort of irritating, and instead it was incompetent and awful. Apparently, Nick disagrees with me about this. I think I was probably wrong about impeachment. I did not expect it to go the way that it went, which is that Democrats sort of got almost lured into a kind of a trap with impeachment, which is to say that leadership was anxious about doing impeachment up front, resisted calls from the kind of progressive base to go ahead with impeachment until the summer when the Ukraine stuff started to come out. And Republicans, particularly in the Senate, started saying stuff like, well, if you can prove a quid pro quo, that would be very bad. And maybe even, you know, kind of, they didn't quite say it would be impeachable, but they sort of suggested it would be pretty, pretty bad. And that was where Democrats started to see, this might be bipartisan. There might actually be Republicans who are going to express real concern here. And then, of course, they went ahead with impeachment, and Republicans were just like, actually, nope, we're going to not worry about this at all. We're going to say maybe it was bad, but definitely not impeachable, and criticized the process a whole bunch. And so I would not have pegged impeachment going the way that it went. I also think I was a little bit wrong about the economy, and I was wrong not just last year, but in particular going into the 2016 election and in the aftermath of the 2016 election. I was really quite worried that Trump's erratic behavior and that policymaking under Trump would have some negative economic effects. And while you can say that there's problems with the economy, and of course there is still a risk of recession at any time, it could happen early this year, it could happen next year. We're certainly like not in a recession-proof mode. Trump has not proven to be an economic disaster. And in some ways, that's just sort of a reminder that presidents don't actually have all that much control over the economy. But I was more worried about that, I think, than the evidence has proven worthwhile.
I'll go next because it's the same point, essentially. I don't know if I tried never to make predictions, but I certainly, a year ago, I think when we were having a similar exercise, I said that my worry about this year that is now passing in front of our eyes was that there hadn't yet been a large calamity during Donald Trump's presidency, and that the two most likely culprits of impending calamity would be the end of the decade-long economic expansion and stock market bubble, and also, you know, some bigger than life, horrible thing happening that's hard to deal with abroad in international relations, because stuff always goes wrong. And so I just kind of presumed that the law of averages would go that way. And in fact, like when I think it was March 1st of this year, it could be last year too, my brain's kind of fudging over, but when Trump came out and sort of announced, oh yeah, we're doing trade war now, the Dow Jones at that moment was something like 24,900 and something. And for months, I delighted in pointing out whenever it would dip back down there again, saying, aha, it's flat. Well, now it's like 28,500 or and rising. Like, it's been a pretty good bull run here for a while. So I don't know if I made that explicit prediction, but like, stuff hasn't gone wrong still. I think stuff might, although that's anticipating a little future
just
thing.
Shortly, to be clear, wrong? Trump's trade war has not gone well, and there's not really much evidence that it has helped the people that it was designed to help. In fact, there's a government study out basically showing that by the Federal Reserve that basically shows that the people who were supposed to be helped were hurt by the trade war. And in fact, we're bailing out the farmers that were supposed to be the beneficiaries of Trump's trade policy. So it's not, this is not, to be clear, a defense of Trump's trade war, just to say that I was worried that there would be some sort of economic calamity that has not yet materialized.
Catherine, you're infallible, as we know, but if you had made a mistake, if you did the crime, what would it have been?
If I did it, by Catherine Maggie Ward, I definitely am not wrong about anything, but if I was wrong about anything, then it was probably just the, you know, even though the 2016 election taught me not to make predictions about electoral politics, like really taught me, like I have many, many times since the 2016 election when people have said like, hey, what do you think will happen in political concern X? I have said, I don't know. I'm not good at guessing those things recently. I'm not going to guess. So I have learned at least a moderate amount of humility. And yet I was very wrong about impeachment. I was very sure that we would not actually have impeachment proceedings. So in some ways, my answer is the same. But it's, I think, part of a broader wrongness, which is that I think have like ossified a little bit in terms of thinking that things are not going to change. And some things have not changed. For instance, our debt and deficit situation is just proceeding merrily along a bad linear trend that shows no signs of changing. Our foreign policy, I would say, is about the same. But there has been real volatility in our politics, and I think the rise of genuinely socialistic candidates has surprised me, even though I could have seen it coming a year ago and did sort of see it coming a year ago. But their success has surprised me. Impeachment has surprised me. And I anticipate more surprises like that in the coming year, that actually fundamental questions about how we conduct our politics are in play in ways that I had kind of gotten accustomed, perhaps as a child of the 90s, as a product of the end of history. I had sort of thought some of these things were over. And even when people were getting sort of hysterical, and even when sometimes reason was getting a little hysterical, I thought like, okay, but this is still not really, the stakes are not really that high here. And I think I take that back. Both on the socialistic side and on the nationalism side, the kind of rise of conservative nationalism has genuinely shaken me, and I would have put quite good money on like, hey, will Rich Lowry write a book about how nationalism is good? I would have been like, nah, calm down, it's fine.
I would have definitely taken that bet.
I wouldn't have. So that's the way I was wrong.
Rob A, what did you get wrong? Yeah. Besides hair choices.
Excuse me. Catherine was kind of leaning into mine there, or one of mine. Yeah, I did not. Obviously, I expected the right to disappoint me and fail me in all sorts of ways and never be libertarian enough or even libertarian at all. But even by that very low bar, they have disappointed me in just full on embrace, in not only embracing things I think are bad, but rejecting things that both libertarians and the right used to sort of agree were good, just like capitalism itself is increasingly unpopular among the ascendant right-leaning or right-centric pundits. Your Sohrab Ahmaris are definitely winning this kind of argument among conservative intellectuals over the David Frenches. Disappointed in or did not expect was just how badly a number of fantasy fiction story things I'm into would just horridly disappoint me. Because this is not something I've experienced before. Usually I've liked the thing, the way the thing I liked has ended. That was true of Lost, Battlestar Galactica. Other people have, you know, bashed these, and I've said, no, it was fine. There were problems, whatever. That has been the norm for me. This year with Star Wars and Game of Thrones, they are so, so bad how they end. They have made the actual property in both cases, Star Wars more egregiously, but also Game of Thrones in very, very frustrating ways, have made the entire property like seem worse. It was so bad.
And I didn't love the end of Game of Thrones, but it was better than the end of Lost.
No, Whoa. That's not true. We actually don't have time for this conversation.
No way. This podcast is only an hour.
Yeah, no, that's a separate boutique.
Write in and tell us if you really want to hear that episode.
Exactly,
listeners.
And we'll put those two in a room and lock the door.
Everyone should pretend that Game of Thrones ends after its sixth season. So, in that, if we're all buying into this fiction, then yes, the Game of Thrones ending was better than Lost because it ends. Okay. There's no more seasons after six.
Yeah,
no more.
All right. Next bit of fun. I want you all to close your eyes, put your, middle
fingers
on your temples.
The light cave? Really?
Stop it.
You're going to defend
your
the light
temples.
Cave.
Stop it.
It only ends once. Everything until then is just progress.
Stop it.
Suderman, you go first because I want you to stop talking about the other thing. in what way is either your own world or your main beat, one of your main beats, mind-bendingly different than it was at this time in 2009, Peter.
So my main policy beat is healthcare, and healthcare is in one way exactly the same, which is to say we're still arguing about whether Obamacare was a failure or not, and Republicans still don't have a great answer on it, and Democrats are still in this weird position of kind of trying to defend it while also admitting that it has a lot of flaws, and hence we need to spend $750 million at least to fix it and to do what it was originally supposed to do. That's Joe Biden's plan. But the way that my main beat is really quite different is that the Obamacare discussion has in some ways evolved into a discussion about Medicare for All, which is to say a single payer plan in which the government is responsible for financing virtually all healthcare in the United States. And that has become a mainstream position within the Democratic Party in a way that it simply was not 10 years ago. And that is a fairly notable development in that passing Medicare for All as Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders would have it, would cost tens of trillions of dollars over a decade in new government spending and would be disruptive and complex on a level that it's really hard to think of any comparable policy in the United States, but in the developed world, where you take the world's biggest healthcare sector, right? So we spend more on healthcare than other countries, and this is one of the arguments that people make for single payer, and transfer all of it to the government. In Bernie Sanders' plan, it would happen in 4 years, and that's really telling about the direction of the Democratic Party, about where the center of gravity has shifted. That is now an idea quite a few of the top tier Democratic presidential candidates, as well as a non-trivial number of rising stars in the party's progressive base, have endorsed pretty wholeheartedly.
Robbie, you wrote a whole book about the thing that you write about. How have things changed since 2009? besides the fact that you are now no longer in diapers.
Right. I mean, I was not actually working on my beat in 2009 because I was still a student at the University of Michigan, just a few months away from beginning my internship at a little place called Reason Magazine.
You were in college experiencing your beat firsthand.
In a way, yes. Although I actually think, so the beat being obviously campus activism, anti-free speech, sort of intolerance, kind of on the left. That was not as much a thing during my years at the University of Michigan. The left that I knew was a lot more interested in classical free speech, kind of ACLU arguments and positions. And it was seeing that change after my graduation that in part made me want to write the book. Of course, some explicit guidance from the government related to Title IX came out in, I think, 2011 that really changed the landscape for some of the due process stuff I write about. It really was a different world back then. I think a lot of the stuff I've chronicled in the years since really did ramp up after that period.
Catherine, how has what you paid attention to changed?
I hate to be a cliche of myself, but rockets. Let's talk about rockets for a minute.
Yes.
The first SpaceX launch wasn't until June 2010. So a lot has happened in the last 10 years. The Ansari X Prize, which was probably, if you're going to kind of put a pin in the beginning of the era of private, you know, the private launch industry, I would put it there. That was 2004. So, you know, that idea had already been born. The concept was out there, but, you know, there have since been, I think, about 80 SpaceX launches. There have been dozens of Blue Origin launches, and we are genuinely on the verge of a manned private launch. Other good space news during the 10 years as well, including China putting a spacecraft on the far side of the dark side of the moon, which was a pretty cool breakthrough that I think got underappreciated.
But aren't they our competitor?
Yeah.
Aren't they our international rival?
Yeah. I hear we hate China, but, you know, it's pretty cool that they did that. And maybe all of humankind will benefit, as per the rhetoric of spaceflight sometimes. And we took a picture of a black hole, which was kind of neat. And then we had a subsequent extremely stupid fight about the gender politics of who took that picture, which was too bad.
So mine might sound a little strange, but in 2009, one of my favorite videos, which I probably found in 2010, internet YouTube things, was a commercial. There's these YouTube songster clowns named Rhett and Link. Who did a commercial for a furniture store in North Carolina called the Red
really?
House.
This is your thing? What? Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
Work with me. These guys are actually pretty good singer-songwriters. And so they, you know, at the Red House. And the punchline of the and the point of the commercial is where black people and white people buy furniture. And it's super funny. And it's the two main people who work in the storeroom. It's like, my name is whatever. I'm black and I sell furniture. And I'm the other person. I'm white and I sell furniture. And then the customers. And it's just really funny and dorky. And I went and I was feeling nostalgic about this like 5 days ago. And I went and did some research. There's a there's a Furniture Today article about the impact of this thing. And I just read, like, this is how different the world is. Viral marketing, a technique that uses word of mouth in the form of electronic referrals rather than traditional marketing campaigns to spread a message, is part of a communications revolution taking place. And, like, you know, interviewing authors saying, you know, David Meerman Scott, bestselling author of The New Rules of Marketing and PR, says Scott said a video goes viral when there is an element of shock and humor, like the Red House video, which many people sent him, or is outrageous or has valuable information. What I'm saying is, we were so innocent 10 years ago, and including a little bit of, like, a racial harmony innocence, perhaps. But certainly back then, the internet was fun.
Oh, the internet's, like, still fun. The internet is full of fun.
The internet was fun.
So, I mean,
it was fun.
Do you ever think about your alternate your alternate life where like your path diverges slightly and you're exactly you, except for you work for Furniture Today?
Yes. Because I had that choice in the late 90s. All right. So I came back to this country in 1998 and I started covering .com stuff. And there was this big, the first .com bubble happened then. And so everyone was literally launching things like space.com, Lou Dobbs, anything. I'm looking around, bookshelves.com was a thing, and they were hiring journalists like crazy because the journalists were all like, I want to get rich. Does that mean I'm going to get rich because it has a .com in the name? And in 1999 and the beginning of 2000, man, you could make a lot of money writing for furnituretoday.com and anything else, whatever the hell, .org. And it didn't last much longer than around April of 2000. And I miss those days because it was fun to write and get a lot of money for things that didn't matter. So it could have happened, but it didn't. Anyways, let's go a lightning round of predictions. And I'm going to give you a choice in the name of saving time here. You can make a prediction for 2020 or you can make a prediction for the 2020s. Ooh. Or if you're fast, you can do both. Robbie, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. Trump will defeat Biden very narrowly in the election. That's my prediction. No GOP senators will vote to impeach the president. None. Maybe one. Maybe like Lisa Murkowski or something. Longer term 2020s prediction, I think because of cancel culture, because of how awful summoning up things you used to tweet or think or post on social media has been, people will increasingly want a private or pseudo-private social media experience, more like auto-deleting snap type things or like group message type things that are shielded from the public view. Those are my predictions.
I appreciate the brevity. Peter, take him up on that.
Netflix will either win a Best Picture award or be eliminated from the Oscars, or both. We will, over the next decade, try some sort of Josh Hawley-ish pro-family subsidy policy stuff, and it will fail. It will simply not do, in aggregate, what it is supposed to do, even though there will be arguments about it. Oh, in this one town in Schenectady or Iowa or whatever, there was six more births per average, right? But like, it won't overall work. And then finally, the next president, whoever it turns out to be, will not do anything substantive to head off Medicare's coming fiscal apocalypse, where it is scheduled to be insolvent by 2026. That is 2 years after our next president is going to either leave office or be reelected if it's not Donald Trump.
Thank you for staying on brand. I shall too, given my new late in life pessimism here. My 2020 prediction is that despite the failure of my 2019 prediction is that, yes, the economy will finally slow down. And my 2020s prediction, dark AF, there will be a conventional war between two countries that have populations larger than 40 million. Catherine, what are your
predictions?
What?
No! That's upsetting.
Yep.
My predictions for the coming year is that we will see some meaningful victories for the Hong Kong protesters, that they will successfully push back on Chinese encroachment on their civil liberties. And my longer term 2020s prediction is that the Hong Kong protesters and their way of life will be crushed by China. It is difficult to imagine that we will survive the decade with the Hong Kong exception in place. And I sincerely hope that I am wrong, but I think there will be hope followed by despair.
Do you view this as a data point in Matt's final prediction? Like somehow the crushing of Hong Kong
will
be part of the lead up to or result of our,
it's certainly
our
easy
awful
to...
conventional war that Matt thinks we're going
to
have?
It's certainly easy to imagine a story in which, yes, those two things are related. And the other thing that I predict is that even though Reason has been predicting this for its whole 50 years, I'm going to predict it again for this next 10, which is that college will finally fall apart. There will always be Harvard and Yale being Harvard and Yale. There will always be big state schools being big state schools. But I think a lot of the other things that look like college right now simply will kind of dissolve into seafoam. Like it has to. They have to. We can't keep going like this, said the editor of Reason Magazine about a thing. The end.
Again, that's great. All right, let's go to our late in the year, late in the podcast, what you have been consuming culturally. Robbie, I understand that you've just been smoking hoolies and knuckling down with The Mandalorian. Is that true?
Yeah, so I've been a bit ill and in bed twice in the last month, and one of those times I binge-watched, so yesterday I binge-watched The Mandalorian, which was pretty good. Not perfect, but so much better than Rise of Skywalker, which again is utter trash that makes me wish Star Wars had never even existed in the first place. The other thing I watched when I was sick was Watchmen, the HBO show. Really good. Damon Lindelof, who's the brains behind The Leftovers and Lost, which is great, despite what Peter Sutterman thinks, put it together. And it's a really thematically linked to the original Watchmen and also just to the Lindelof world. And it's really good. Better than The Mandalorian, actually.
Watchmen and The Leftovers show that we were all wrong about Damon Lindelof, and Lost and Rise of Skywalker show we were all right about J.J. Abrams.
I'm a little bit lost. So, Peter, continue.
I have been watching the first season of The Terror, a historical horror series aired on AMC. The first one is about the crossing of the Arctic, the effort to find the Northwest Passage. It's based on a Dan Simmons story. Dan Simmons famously being the author of some... the Hyperion books, which are sort of sci-fi horror. And this is it. Now, the series is an anthology of historical horror. So basically a real life event set in history somewhere. And then there's a monster. And so they're trying to cross the Arctic back when they didn't know how to do that. They get stuck in the ice and there's a monster, and it's beautiful and haunting and just sort of super cool to look at. And everybody speaks in these deep gravelly tones, and they're always like drinking scotch because it's super cold out and they don't have anything to do because it's the winter, and they're just like stuck in the ice, and there's a freaking monster hunting all of them, and it's really kind of great.
I watched the first two episodes of that, and it was horrifying even without the monster to imagine like being on a cold boat in the Arctic like for months.
Peter's like, what if you were cold and all there was to do was drink whiskey? Like,
drink
monsters
are
secondary.
And read books.
Forget about a blow dryer.
And like, there's no Twitter, there's no internet, and you don't have anything that you have to do either, except, you know, kind of wash things and like cook food, but it's just like
shivers.
Right. But also you don't have to be like, the boat isn't rocking anymore. You can just like make fires outside and things are cold, and you wear like giant, like animals.
I'm
like
so
sort of
confused by
you.
this recommendation, because I really, really liked the words Dan Simmons in this recommendation, and then I didn't like any of the other words.
You would not like it, Catherine.
I think you actually might enjoy this.
She would
in
not
some
like
ways.
It.
So basically, if you like the North of the Wall sequences in Game
I
of
did.
Thrones, and wished that they were a little bit colder in tone.
And
I mean,
like,
right?
Like, also
sort of like,
more
like
tentacles.
Removed. So there's the monster doesn't actually show up all that much, right? It's
oh,
it,
that's
the monster
the worst
is
kind of monster.
Just out there.
No,
and you see occasionally the results
the
of
parts
the monster,
of the
but people just think it's a bear at first.
The parts of Hyperion and the other Dan Simmons books in that mold that I really don't like are the parts where he's like, and now 15 pages of things dripping off of things. Like that's
oh, yeah.
I'm
so
like,
this is like 9 hours of things dripping off of
okay.
stuff.
I
while
like, I like
while
the
everything
clever
is very cold.
Like playing off of the Decameron. Like, is there some of that? That's kind of what I'm here for with the Dan Simmons. The Tempest. Is it Shakespeare, but also Greek mythology?
Maybe,
but
just
also
a
Inuit
little
mythology.
Bit of that, but
okay.
Yeah, I don't
All right.
think that's the primary thing that's going on.
Speaking of things that are also Greek mythology, what I'm consuming is Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which I had never read, and I was just like, you know what, I should read this great series that people seem to love. That like is very much up my alley in that it is riffing off of classical literature while also being, you know, lightly written modern science fiction and fantasy-ish young adulty tropey novels. So I'll let you know how those go. But I'm reading them.
Talk about those with my eldest.
I would love to. We can have a book club.
You should have a book club. I watched, speaking of eldest and also youngest, saw Frozen on Broadway. I'm in a Frozen vortex, people. There's nothing that I can do about this anymore. And it was great. If you like Frozen, you like those songs. They had a bunch of new songs and funny. And there's even some nudity. So it's a lot of good stuff. But that's not what I'm going to talk about here, even though I just talked about it. A long time listeners may recall I've had some trouble over the years with family movie night in the Welch household.
But now you just watch Frozen over and over again, and that solves it, right?
This led, for instance, last year for our Christmas family movie night, the atrocity of Jingle All the Way as a selection over what clearly should have been Elf, and I still haven't totally got over it. So this year, I instituted ranked choice voting.
Wow, and how's it going there?
We had a couple of rounds, and we alighted on an animated film that came out in just this November.
You chose to criticize the process.
Called Klaus, which is a kind of retelling of the beginning of the Santa Claus myth. And as my wife points it out, as we were very much enjoying it about halfway through, she's like, this couldn't be American. It's too dark. And in fact, it's a Spanish animated Christmas comedy, even though Jason Schwartzman and J.K. Simmons and Norm Macdonald, among other people, are doing voices in there. But it's a meditation on the incentives of government workers, especially the postman. I don't want to give away too much, but very, very funny, very, very dark, clan warfare, and a bunch of other stuff, too. I highly recommend putting it into your Christmas queue of movies for next year, now that we've all
also
moved on.
And everyone's end of the year queue, of course, should be Dave Barry's Year in Review. Don't forget. It's the best thing to remember what happened this year, and it's out, and it's delightful as always, though the really, really funny bits are the Joe Biden parts. So just get ready for that.
I totally appreciate you reminding me of that, because that is my favorite thing to read at the end of the year at all times. So thank you for listening. Have a happy and safe New Year's Eve out there in listenerdom, and we'll catch you next week here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thanks, Robbie.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Goodbye now.